I have a question. Would you rather that we have soup kitchens for the rest of our days, or that all the people are fed by a program of government in a way that we no longer have to have volunteer soup kitchens, that everybody just gets, you know, their breakfast at schools, and it just becomes part of the norm that everybody is fed and everybody has a house and everything like that? Where would you rather be at?
I'd rather be at the latter.
I'd rather soup kitchens.
How about a third alternative where there isn't even a need for either one?
That's what I mean, basically. Soup kitchens prefer to a government program, though. Okay. Is that what I hear you saying? In other words, I'd rather not have a bureaucratic setup for something than a soup kitchen, which at least has some honest...
You've got honest people working to solve a problem.
Right. But would you rather that nobody would need a soup kitchen?
Of course.
As a result of some government action that allowed the free people up
but
to have
Gina
jobs?
But as Gina said, they'll always be poor.
Transformation.
I hear
you need
that.
To read all of Deuteronomy 15.
I hear that. And we must honor that idea at the same point that we don't let it
direct our judgment.
That's correct.
But I think there's an issue of reality, too.
Okay. But where how far should we exist in reality in terms of, yes, it may not happen today or tomorrow, but can we look to a future?
We should never stop trying.
And that's part of what we're trying to get at here. Is action in a political arena a reasonable one, and do we dare to make mistakes? Let me read something which may be very upsetting to you, but it's from the St. Paul's Pioneer Press, March 14th, 1993, front page of section 1B, okay, which is the metro area. First page of this metro area. Treaty talks incite war of words. Agreement foes backers getting personal in debates. R. James Addington stood before the Minnesota Senate Committee armed with the full backing. This is the press talking, remember. The full backing of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America in Minnesota that gives most state legislators pause. The director of the St. Paul-based Progressive Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota told the committee a proposed Mille Lacs Lake Treaty Agreement was honorable and just. It was, he said, precisely what the church had in mind when it adopted a resolution last year calling for church advocacy on American Indian treaty rights and tribal sovereignty. It seems to us that the underlying issue is not a question of walleyes and nets, it is a matter of justice, Addington said. Senator Charles Byrd was unimpressed. The legislature's most outspoken opponent of the agreement is a feisty DFL populist from the western Minnesota rural enclave of Chocillo. He suggested Addington visit Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Chocillo. If he did, Byrd added, he would find plenty of Lutherans who didn't agree with him. I think they would run you until your heel smoked, Berg snapped as treaty supporters in a packed hearing room winced, and opponents laughed appreciatively. The church steps into the political arena.
Mm-hmm. Where would we go?
But remember, this is a reasonable sort of exchange that is going on here. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
We have the Lutheran Church, the ELCA has a government office in Washington, D.C., the Office of Governmental Affairs. And in various states, it has these types of groups, such as the Lutheran Coalition in Minnesota. I forget how many states it is, but it's over 10. And within those states, they're synodically supported, possibly in combination with Lutheran Social Service. It varies from state to state a little that way. And from the synodical support, the issues come and bubble out of the synods, come to a group, a board, which then tries to figure out how to influence legislation. And I'm going to read one portion. It's just the beginning. armed with the full backing of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, in Minnesota, that gives most state legislators pause. The power of saying that a large group of your voters who feel very strongly and ethically and morally and are backing a situation which is not in their interest. It's not in their personal interest. We're not talking about somebody coming in lobbying for their own oil company or something like that. But is speaking out for somebody they feel has been oppressed. It is not easy to shrug off that. It's different to say, well, the bishops all have signed a letter, which is still a good thing, but I mean, it's different than saying the constituents from which we come from have agreed that this is an issue which should bubble up. Yes?
But on the other hand, other lobbyists also bring money and perks to legislators, and mm-hmm. I don't think Lutheran Social Ministry or whatever the group in different states is called do. How does that affect legislators, I wonder?
Oh, it has an enormous effect. However, to give you some idea how these kind of groups operate, at least from the Lutheran Coalition, I'm vice chair of the Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy, a lay member. We have a staff member from each one of the synods we've represented in Minnesota. We have a clergy member, and then we have a lay representative from each. We then have a member from Lutheran Social Service to sit on the board, etc. So we have this kind of design, the thing that happens is when we get together as a group and we decide on some issues and we bring them forth, a lot of times it's to support existing legislation, another time it's to suggest legislation to sensitive legislators. But the first thing we do, the very first thing we do, is have a breakfast with the legislature and say, we're not going to talk issues with you unless you ask us to. We're going to support your legislative work at the beginning of the biennial session as telling them you're not crooks. Most of you are very committed people, and we believe that legislation is a calling to do the public good. You were not voted in to support your legislative district. You were voted in to do the greatest good for the public. And that is a calling of ministry. A ministerial calling. At least that's how we approach it. That may not ring for everybody, but that's how we approach it, that we feel that at its utmost, legislative is a calling.
And can I have you repeat what you said? Because I'm not sure I heard that.
Yes, that basically they didn't come into the legislature just to support their district and to do what the majority of people in their district said they should do. It's not only representing them, it's to do the common good.
For the whole state.
I agree with that. Now let me paraphrase it.
Please.
You didn't come into your office to do what the people elected you to do, but what you, in your ivory tower position, think is best for everybody.
I don't think that's a fair paraphrase.
That's what I hear.
I hear that's what you're saying. But what we're saying is that
I have a problem with the intellectuals who sit up here and say, I'm so smart, or I am in such a position of power,
right,
that I know what you need, regardless of what you think.
Is that
what you think the legislature is supposed to do?
No, don't misunderstand. But
it's not exactly that. In other words, most of the time they will vote for the legislative district. But there are some issues that are so important that they have to go back and take a very difficult stand, even if it goes against the majority.
I don't disagree with what you're saying, but it's a very, very fine line.
It's an extremely fine line, and that's why we exist. They come over to us and say, I just want to use you as a sounding board. And not all Lutherans may believe, and we're trying to be pretty honest. We try to say, there is no common agreement here. If you went to one church, you may hear a lot of things. If you go to another, you go to another one. But we give them the straight talk as much as we can. And we say, if they see an abortion, we say, hey, 50-50, divide it. Mm-hmm. 50% say it's a tragic choice. 50% don't want it to even be a choice. Yeah. It's just too horrendous for them to. But the Lutheran statement on abortion always says that, and whenever it's used, it's a tragic choice. Mm-hmm. It's a tragic choice. And they go away saying, okay, I wasn't given a set answer. I was given some thoughts by a body that mulls this around and comes up from the citizens. I'm not saying, we don't devise these things ourselves. I mean, sometimes an issue hits us that we didn't expect. But that's how an issue comes in, and we start to work on it. And if we do it wrong, believe me, we will hear. We will hear. But we say, for example, on the issue of, one of the issues was on gambling, expanding gambling in Minnesota. And I mean beyond the Native American casinos. Just, you know, open it up all wide. And we said the damage that that does to people is incredible. Mm-hmm. And they were expanding it to bars and things like that. Mm-hmm. And they said, we sent in our St. Paul Bishop, Lowell Erdahl, and it came on the news because it was this sort of back and forth thing, because they called him to the hearing. And they said to him, well, we would bet that if you took a poll of 2/3 of your Lutherans would be gamblers. And he said, you know, and 100% of them are sinners. You know, that's what Lowell came back like that. He said, we don't have to go back and say, just because our Lutherans gamble, that we have to represent their gambling. See, we as representatives of the Lutherans don't have to say, well, we're going to support your gambling habits. We're going to say we don't support gambling because the expansion of gambling. And yet we find ourselves in a difficult point of view when we come to the Native American populations, because it's their first set of economic power. It's the first time they can build schools. It's the first time they got a foothold, toehold into the economy, that they're finally getting medical care and they're finally getting education. Yes, there's been some problems with it. Yes, there's been some crime involved. Yes, there have been problems. However, we have find ourselves at a difficulty there. And yet when the majority population starts doing gambling to support bar owners and things like that, it's much clearer to us that we have a different situation here. That there was no inequity in the past. The bar owners are complaining because the Native Americans seem to be doing so well. And yet the bar owners in those neighborhoods are doing well too. It's not like the business is going away. But they want more business, or they want to share that pie. Nobody was asking for the share of the grief when the Native Americans were doing badly. Mm-hmm. But they want a share of the action when they're doing well. These are some of the difficult things that we have to mull around in the group and send back to the synods because we go on these things. How do you get into one of these things? First of all, these are not exclusive clubs. We have action networks. People can be part of it, and they can disagree vociferously with our opinion, and we certainly ask them to do so, and they can agree with it. And we do go and we try to look to what the churches feel are issues that we should be involved in, and we look to as much to the gospel as we can, and we mull these issues around. Let's give you some ideas of the kinds of things we're looking at in the environment, in the environmental area. In the environmental area, one of the big concerns now is large-scale hog production. I mean large-scale corporate stuff owned by the Prudential Corporation, things like that. We as a church decided not to necessarily take a stand initially on it, but rather to look at the possibilities for what does it do to families and family farms? What does it do to farm communities? These are the questions we ask. What does it do to the land? Does it have positive features, etc.? And then we brought people together on a forum in the safety of the church, and it was a number of churches that came together, including the Roman Catholic, etc. We all came together within the safety of that and said, we're here to hear all opinions, and we're here to hear what the people who do this farming have to say versus people who want these large-scale production facilities. And that's how we start. We start with issue forums. And within the safety of the church, and I mean the safety, that doesn't mean the church sits there and is, you know, has no opinion on the matter. Well, we don't want to say, yes, we're for killing, and yes, that's fine, and we affirm your position. But we do sit there and in the safety and the love and forgiveness and the affirmation of that kind of environment, ask people to air some very difficult. And then, from those issue forums, we gather up what we feel are the essences of that and go forward to the legislature with bills that have resulted in things like the Corporate Farm Act to make sure that, yes, family farms are fine and cooperative agreements are fine among farmers, but we're not looking for the whole state to go cooperative, I mean to go corporate farming, in the sense that the way the land uses have gone in other states. Some of these large-scale production facilities have been bought up for multi-million dollars, left incredible environmental destruction, and gone to another state. We're looking at the history, we're not just being naive about it and saying, well, we're against all corporate farming. That's ridiculous. Because within a corporation, there are farmers who farm those lands and may do a very good job. So it's not a philosophy, we're against corporations or against corporate farming. We're against those kinds of things that are destructive, and we're for those kinds of things which are productive. Let me give you an example which is very tough, and I'd like to open this up. I'm going to read a thing that we just jumped on because we thought it was a good issue, and I'll explain how we got involved. And then let me show you how the fire broke out in the church. And this is a biggie. This is one with really, it still is occurring too. And I don't want you to take sides with this either way. By the way, there's a new organization out called the Green Cross, which you now can become involved in, similar to the Red Cross. I advise looking at it. New movements of the ecology with religion. That doesn't mean you have to join it. I haven't yet. I'm still waiting to see how it falls out. But it's at least something that we're starting to think about, that it's not improper to mix your faith with
reality.
With reality and make it a political movement that actually affects a larger change perhaps than you can do locally. But don't give up on those local things. I mean, but if someone wants to see that, we can see that. Let me give you I can even show you the sheet.
Do you see part of your responsibility or thrust being educational to legislators?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes. And affirmation, education, and then how to deal with their constituents. Like we do minister to them as well. I mean, the whole idea is if they get a punch in the stomach for having taken a very moralistic stand. Some people voted for extension of rights to all people, including gays in the society, not to be discriminated against, housing, etc. That passed. It was a civil rights type of legislation. And some of them voted against their own district to some degree and are, you know, received a major black eye from their district. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, if a legislator is only looking to get reelected, they will only vote in their self-interest. But if a legislator is doing their job, they will vote, they will come to their district and try to explain how they feel they want to vote and why, and have the district decide one way or the other whether they believe that's not the right way to go. And there should be risk-taking with legislators, as well as listening to the district. They shouldn't be just above the district. The people there have a right to be heard, but the legislature has a calling and has to meet that as well. And sometimes it's going to be, maybe 99% of the time, they'll be voting their district's way, but there's going to be a small time when there's some issues that they feel that they just can't let this area control it because it's larger than the district understood, for example. Okay. This was NSP and Earth Day, Northern States Power. And Northern States Power has chosen Earth Day for its 1992 annual meeting, yet NSP is the largest polluter in Minnesota because it relies on nuclear and fossil fuels to provide electric utility service. And it goes on, and more money, it produces more high-level radioactive waste and global warming and all this other stuff. Anyway, we put our name at the bottom of this deal, okay? Stop NSP's radioactive waste dump at Perry Island, et cetera, okay? The reason we went on this list is because the idea was to store radioactive casks 12 inches thick of steel. I mean, incredible engineering, just incredible. And yet, the radioactivity would be so high at the edge of those casks, they still have to be buried in dirt. to prevent the radiation from getting out. I mean, that, and it's on Prairie Island in the Mississippi floodplain, okay? That's where the plant is. And it's right next to, and it's right next to the reservation.
Is it reservation land or next to reservation?
Right next to reservation land. However, pollution extends beyond boundaries. They already have treated drinking water, and it's not really fit for drinking on the reservation. Tritium comes from use of radiation.
Right.
The other thing that happens is when they built the road out, when they first built the plant, nobody asked the Native Americans whether they should build the plant there. When they built the road over reservation lands, nobody asked the reservation whether that. When they built the casks to the reservation, it was the final straw. Or when they proposed to build the casks. It went up through a number of things, including the Public Utilities Commission, who said it seemed like a reasonable plan, let's go ahead with it. And yet, there is no permanent federal facility to house radioactive waste. So this is classified a temporary facility. And therefore, it's temporary until there's a permanent one. And therefore, it might go on forever, but it's temporary. Now, the way the administrative law judge saw it is it should go to the state legislature, and that's all the Native Americans are asking, that they be heard at the state legislature level, because they are a sovereign nation and have the right to have it dealt with at the state legislature. We said, regardless of the scientific merits, one way or the other, we just want their voice to be heard at the legislative level, in combination with the things that were said at the Public Utility Commission, all the scientific evidence, etc. But their voice should be heard. And we stand based on the quincentenary observation of that event. And we say we're making no statements about the radiation at this point. We're just standing in concert with that event, okay? That's all we did. That's all we did. Well, the next thing we know, the bishop has written, etc. And this gives you, if you see all these pages here, this is a list of charges written up against us on a chronology of events by employees of NSP as a member of a church, which they have the right to do. And they came up with a list of charges against us to be read at a church council, which they invited us down to, and we came and they gave it to us. That's after they met with us the first time on that red wing. So it's not like we do something heavy-handed. We always converse with it. And this is still ongoing. I mean, it's still an ongoing thing. So basically, one church in the group in Red Wing, Minnesota, stopped giving to the Synod with regards to anything that supported any effort we did. This is a small proportion of what we do. And we invited everybody to join the Lutheran Coalition and sit on the board or do anything they want to influence other decisions as well. It became a one-issue thing, and they stopped giving. If the church takes other positions, will people stop giving into the church for other reasons?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's quite interesting that of all the things we do, you know, hunger, you know, we have a whole hunger, you know, we have it on the farm area, we have policies in whole bunches of areas. I mean, you know, children and, you know, health care and... we've tried to help with health right and all these other bills to, you know, to insure people that have not insured and all that sort of thing. And this was a minor part of environmental stuff and actually hit us from the side. And just because we supported it, it becomes a major thing in the church. Now, it has come to our... It's quite an interesting set of thing. And the one thing they did tend to get upset about is that our sense that we said that it was environmental racism. And that really bothered them heavily. And a number of these people are well placed on church boards. These companies place people on church boards and insist that they work, act, etc.
How did the people downriver in Iowa, Illinois, and Missouri feel about that?
Well,
we've had
I understand.
Caskets washed up that apparently were in.
Yeah, I know. You know, it's hard to get a feeling for it because I'm not sure how much they know. I mean, it's not like these things are heavily advertised. They're sort of dug up by the press and all. To give you some idea of the reactions.
By the press.
the reactions. It says, such involvement would put NSP in the forefront of corporations battling institutionalized racism. NSP is already in the forefront. It employs Native Americans from the local community, two of whom are in senior management positions on the plant operations staff. One of those individuals was previously a tribal council president. NSP awarded $200,000 to various Native American agencies and programs in 1992 and received the Responsive Philanthropy Award from the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. The people at NSP Prairie Island have a history of generosity for causes that transcend race, creed, or color. For example, NSP Prairie Island contributions make up one quarter of the entire Red Wing United Way goal. NSP Prairie Island team was the top fundraiser in the Red Wing March of Dimes Walkathon. They're a good corporation. They have been for a long time. However, money and these other good efforts do not necessarily equal no environmental racism. To tell a group, well, your voice shouldn't be heard, we know better, the Public Utilities Commission already said it's a reasonable plan. We said we don't have to get into the issue of science. They'll murder you, you know. Because that's not what we're trying to fight here anyway. That doesn't mean we should be ignorant of it and not bring in scientific information. But what we were really saying is not that it should be decided one way or the other. We were not saying, you know, we said that we want their voice to be heard as far as they want it to be heard. We will stand in solidarity with an oppressed group till the time when their voice, they feel that sufficient voice has been heard. And that will keep it as a long-standing relationship that will develop with this community. And we will keep that relationship going as long as we possibly can beyond this issue. And that was what we said. And that was our sole grounds for it. And it's still a very difficult issue. Think about it. What do you think are the results? I mean, it's not NSP's fault that people want so much power. It's not their fault that this was the siting of a nuclear plant. It's not their fault that there's no place to put the darn radioactive waste. And they're trying their best to do the best engineering possible. However, what is the upshot of this? The upshot is, at some point, the church has to take a stand when they feel that there is some oppression going on. Not that, ultimately, you wouldn't turn into a good plan. I don't believe it's a good plan based on what I've seen. But that's my personal opinion. That's a personal opinion. And I cannot let that get into the fray of things. My personal thing is that if the Native Americans said, we want this site here, that's fine, we just want the protection involved, it was one thing. But when the tribe said, you never asked us about this ever, and all this stuff's running over tribal land, including on multiple roads and all this stuff, and the transporting of waste goes over our, you know, reservation, and our water's already polluted, etc. That to me speaks that somebody has some difficulty. Sure.
Could I raise just a theoretical question?
Sure.
What if the government had told the Indians they were going to pay them, say, the equivalent of something they get from gambling, an enormous sum, if they could build their waste disposal plant on Indian land, mm-hmm. and the Indians accepted that, then how, and the community realized that this was dangerous and in the floodplain and no one could predict the ramifications in 100 or 1,000 years, then how would you have also reacted to it?
We would react in an educational sense, in a solidarity sense, make sure that they had the best facility possible, the best monitoring possible, and continued, you know, that they had the Pell's health care so that they could make sure that any health effects were seen early on, all that sort of thing. But if they wanted it, it would be one thing. But when they say we don't want it, and the Public Utility Commission says we know better, then, and that the state law reads, and it's a very fine line, state law reads that if this were a permanent facility, there would be no question to go to state legislature. That's all they're asking, that their voice be heard at the state legislature. NSP, that they should apologize to NSP, the Native Americans, for the grief they're causing the plant. The second thing that was told is that they should convince the federal government to find an appropriate permanent site. The Native response is, it'll be on another reservation of another one of our brothers, our sisters,
in another place, because that's where many of the nuclear sites are located, in far places, far away from places where, which is mainly native land, you know, reservations and things. Uranium mines have been on native lands and things. I mean, they're concerned that if you push it away, you're going to be pushing it onto somebody else, and that's not the issue they're looking for. They're looking to have their voice heard. It's not, they don't feel it's their job to tell the federal government to put it on another, to set up a permanent site. So there's some really interesting questions that come up. It doesn't make the corporation a bad person or a bad corporation. It doesn't make the workers bad for fear of their own jobs. We have to be ministering to them. It doesn't make the churches bad for having supported their own workers in their own churches. It doesn't make the pastor bad. It's just the process. We've never learned the process of how to argue political things in the church, because politics was supposed to stay outside the church, and we've never learned the process of bringing it in and hearing that.
I think it goes one step beyond that, Steve. I think that within the church we have never learned to argue anything and been able to agree to disagree and still be brothers and sisters. We tend to say, I disagree with you, and therefore one of us has to go. Mm-hmm. And I think the church needs to get over that hump, whatever the issue is.
There's a couple of issues that I see there. One is, as a society, we tend to take a very lazy attitude about finding out issues until something butts up against us, and then we get upset about it, and then we have a fit. The other thing is that the company is making a great mistake, and perhaps the church has been making a mistake, like you just inferred, in that it isn't involving public participation. It isn't involving the people of the church. It's involving the public, the people that have a stake in whatever the issue might be. Mm-hmm. Obviously, from my point of view, is that everybody who would be involved in that temporary, quote-unquote, temporary disposal site should be involved in at least its first interview and the opportunity to come to the difficult consensus of what the proper thing to do needs to happen. Likewise, the church should be having a similar discussion about these kind of issues. They have to some degree, but generally it's somebody says, well, I'll just go off and do my own thing, or I'll pull back my money. Mm-hmm. We need to be listening to the congregations and through an informed discussions, it's not a simple process, it takes a long time, come home to what we can live with and live by that decision or that agreement, hopefully that consensus.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. Go here. Please.
Yes. getting this consensus means that everybody knows exactly the facts and there's somebody that they can believe that this is the truth, this and this is the way to go. And I find extremely, this whole discussion, particularly with power, getting that particular consensus was extremely difficult. It's always a finite doubt. Well, what about 100 years from now or 500 years from now? And there will be somebody there who was, you know, maybe have a point or may not have a point. Maybe just trying to create an emotional issue for a political agenda or something. And it plants enough doubt in the people's mind, even though all the scientific evidence can be in the other way,
right,
that everybody will hold us up. For example, the whole process of nuclear lightening the plants, right? Mm-hmm. That's become such an astronomical long time now that the cost of nuclear plants is totally out of sight.
Right.
You can't even do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's political. So I think that whole process is a very awkward process.
Yes, but, yes, okay, please.
But I have a response to that. My own sense of the reading is that there is a way to dispose of the waste product. If you turn it into glass, it works a whole lot better than trying to store it in 12-inch thick. Anyway, that's a scientific issue, and once you turn it into glass, it's no longer economically feasible. There it is. That's where the economic issue of nuclear plants is, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, there's a whole recycling things that are going on in Europe and stuff like that that people are doing over there that we aren't doing here for political reasons. So, you know, we're making life tough here, and I object sometimes to that particular Nestino or hearing.
I hear that.
Okay,
that's
but I had another question to redirect us back to this issue.
Right.
And my question is, in the pages that you have there of the charges that were brought against you, did they recognize that it was, that what you sought was voice for the native people?
No.
They never recognized what you saw as the issue.
No.
So they're charging you with other stuff.
So in a sense you're talking past each other.
Misinformation.
Misinformation.
Yes, we're going past each other. However, there were some misstatements of even scientific concern that I got to sit in on. I mean, they said gamma rays and x-rays were exactly the same, and you know, all sorts of interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to focus on this one individual issue. I'm using it as an example, because we have, if you go for environmental stewardship, you'll see education as part of it, and even advocacy, either indirect or direct, creating miles for earthkeeping, you know, recycling, you know, all sorts of things, congregations and eco-entrepreneurial projects, pools of Christian environmentalists such as scientists, engineers, in other words, really bringing some people together, establishing the Green Cross. All these are part of the existing, these are existing advocacy positions that the church is going toward. It's an interesting, yes, the difficulty of finding the true facts is very difficult. It's very difficult, but we shouldn't allow it to paralyze us. In some ways, taking a position, we're willing to back off us being incorrect. We're willing to back off that. We're willing to say at some point that somebody had the information wrong. But to not go forward when we hear somebody screaming, problem, problem, and that they didn't have a voice. They traditionally haven't had a voice. If we look at that we speak for the voiceless, those who don't have a voice before, those who are hungry, those who are homeless, those are our traditional audiences anyway. And so we find that if environmental problems impact these people, then we go forward to speak on those matters. Lead poisoning. We went forward heavily on the lead abatement bill, knowing that it would help mostly the poor. There wasn't any money put behind it, but there was a lead abatement bill, and we went ahead with that. That's an environmental problem that mainly that traditionally affects the inner city people who are of low income. And ways of taking off the wall, you know, so that, you know, methods for spraying it with water and scraping it down and things, and they provided some money so that can be done properly. Because there were even the people who were remodeling old houses and giving their kids lead poisoning because they were sanding it off and making particulate which flew all over the place and inhaling it and giving their kids lead poisoning. So there was all sorts of positions, but one of the biggest ones, of course, two of the biggest ones are power generation and the results of that. And the second one that's very big in our state is agriculture. And there's no getting around it. We do not want to damage agriculture in our state. I mean, it's damaged enough by, you know, the flooding and all now and poor farm policy and all that. But we stand in support of the farm communities and the farmers and all to get a decent wage and to get on their farms and to do a good job and to limit their pesticide use as much as possible. And, you know, again and again and again. So if a bill comes forward or we can suggest some things, we did something very, very controversial. Bovine growth hormone came forward. Mm-hmm. And we were said, what should we do about this? I got a phone call in Washington, D.C. at a conference. And Jim...
Bovine growth hormone.
That for increased milk production. Mm-hmm. And we went in and Jim said, what should we do about this? Should we support the moratorium on it till more is known? And I said, based on what I've seen here at the conference, I'd say yes. So we went ahead and took a stand, and our legislators were angry at us, something awful, that we came forward with that position and supported the moratorium. More data was gathered. They said, why shouldn't ours have the advantage over other states? And they're not wrong. There are 100, what do you tell to those 100 farmers that go out of business in the dairy industry that, I mean, that's what we were faced with. You're going to tell them they can't use it and increase it? Well, interestingly enough, later on I had a student do a study as what were the size of Minnesota farms and what advantage would it have if it was used nationwide. It was found out, first of all, the productivity of the cattle might go down in terms of the reproduction. So those who are trying to maintain their own cattle would have a problem. If milk prices dropped just a small amount, it would not be advantageous. Mm-hmm. Those in the southeast United States would have a better advantage from it because with the increased production, you now have to have a higher quality of food. And over the wintertime, the food quality drops in Minnesota because mm-hmm. of storage. Mm-hmm. So it's now increased cost to the farmer. You'd have to have over 100 head of cows to even start to be profitable, and a lot of herds were under 100 from what a student had followed around and looked around. I mean, so you started realizing that there was a lot of misinformation on the other side because they jumped at this biotechnology without having looked at all sides as well. They were looking for the quick fix themselves. So the moratorium was not to say we should never have bovine growth hormone, which can also create diabetes and stuff in the cattle themselves. I mean, if you get too much growth hormone. But not but the increased milk production also has increased costs of mastitis, and they have to have cleaner, more sanitary conditions for their cattle because of the increased production, and there's more wasting, and there's more all sorts of things, a higher degree of management, higher degree of food quality, everything, a lot of increased cost and maintenance and time to be put in that cattle population with increased herd size. And the question is, do we need more milk to begin with? When you consider how much milk was going in. And some of these things showed that the farmers were going to go out of business one way or the other. As a matter of fact, if it was adopted nationwide, Minnesota farmers would probably go out more out of business than in another state, which was warmer over the winter months and therefore could produce the higher quality of food. So there was no advantage necessarily to Minnesotans if it was adopted nationwide. However, they're looking to get the jump on other states and use it quickly, and then if it kicked in all other states, oh, I'm sorry, we made a mistake later, you know. It was an interesting thing. So the moratorium was to study further, not to say we're against it, but we don't think enough study has been done on either side of the issue, both on our side or on your side. Now, the one thing they did tell us, never do that again to us, is blindside them. We blindsided them with that support. We should have contacted them initially, letting them know it was going to happen, so they could at least hold on to the railings. You know, no, I'm serious.
Yeah.
And they
that's a fundamental courtesy.
And that's a fundamental courtesy that we should have done. Because somebody got in my face, I actually wound up to the legislature, and we were trying to talk about another issue, and he was just so upset about that one. So there are ways of approaching courteously our legislators, talking individually with them, becoming part of a consensus group. And you could be on any part of these groups. You can be, you say, I want the environmental aspect. I don't want to hear about the rest. I want to hear about only about the hunger aspect. I only want to hear about the children aspect. I only want to hear, see, we allow people to only become of a network. Now, the network is not told to form legislators. They say, here's the issue as far as we can tell, with all the information that we have. We want you immediately to write if you feel you want to. But if not, people can pick up that piece of paper if they're on our network list and say, wait a second, I don't agree with this. And they can write exactly opposite of what we want to the and that's what we want, the freedom of each individual to write to their individual legislator. We don't go in necessarily just to lobby them one-on-one with some higher up. It actually funnels right back into the congregation to call. The choice is still in the hands of the people who do it. So basically, what does the church do? The church evaluates where the synods are at and where they say the problems are. And these are not necessarily always Lutherans. We got smacked on this NSP thing because most of the Native population was not Lutheran. And our good Lutherans were at the NSP plant. And what the heck were we doing? That is not in the sheets, but boy, did we get a lot of that. I mean, what good does the Lutheran church not supporting their own Lutherans?
What about the religious right in the Midwest? Is that a real factor it is in the Southwest?
In various parts of Minnesota, some synods are more conservative than others. But I'm not sure it's a religious right. It's more conservative districts and more districts that are way out there. I mean, if you go to St. Paul, they've got all sorts of resolutions passing like crazy, okay? That's the city of St. Paul. And then you go out to the Northwest and you'll find people a lot more conservative in Minnesota. But that's good. It does. But
conservative and religious right aren't necessarily the same thing. Sometimes they may.
Well, I understand that. I hate to put a label on it because I know what you mean in terms of religious right, fundamentalist, etc. You know, whatever.
Yeah, there's some. Yeah, very organized. Yeah.
I understand. There's some very organized things. So we do have Operation Rescue and all sorts of things involved. But instead of labeling it, I think we do have a balance in the church. Even in the Lutheran church, we have a balance of a lot of different people doing a lot of different things. And I think the trick is never to let it be a top group from the top down dictating issues down to the synods. They've got to percolate up. You start an issue forum on an issue. I mean, on an issue that's important. If you think it's farming here, you say farming, you know, whatever, as your issue forum. You bring people into a church, and you start discussing farming problems. You try to focus it because you don't want it to get so far awry that you never get anything out of it. And you also invite them into a network. And that's how the church's advocacy is going right now. We're fighting for things like hunger and farming and environment are all right there. It's hard to split them all up, but all we come across over. As a matter of fact, most of our money comes out of the hunger fund. Most for the advocacy comes out of the hunger aspect, because for some reason that's how a lot of this originated, to environmental, but it turned into other issues that we have. We have more than one issue. I mean, we have an environmental issue, and to give you some idea, let me read some of the statements here and see what you think about how we approach it. We have issue statements similar to church statements, so that if a legislator wants to find out where we stand, we have a listing of what we want to do. And this was an earlier definition. We give a definition of environmental stewardship as caretaking of creation. Caretaking means enhancement and maintenance of the physical, biological, and aesthetic values of our environment. We view ourselves as caretakers of our inherited creation rather than owners of the world's resources. We feel we are called to pass on this inheritance to future generations in enhanced form. Basic principles of legislation that we support in environmental areas based on our faith commitment. This is how we go about it. Encourage environmental stewardship, dominion as opposed to domination, abuse, or using up limited, unrenewable resources. Convert to renewable energy resources, recycling as opposed to continued use of fossil fuels and waste production. And we'd say the state government can take the lead in this area, especially requiring its own departments and agencies to use increased percentages of recycled materials, etc. Ensure biological diversity through maintenance of habitat and decreasing all forms of pollution which impact quantity and quality of life. Reclaim areas where environmental abuse has occurred for physical, biological, and aesthetic purposes. Decrease reliance on chemical pesticides for agriculture, which have been seen to contaminate soil and water resources, and require increased use as resistance develops. Development of natural methods of pest control is indicated on our statements on farm policy. Long-term solutions approach in a transition from present practices instead of short-term fixes. And funding methods. Recycle requires less hauling and stimulates growth in the development of recycling industries. Renewable resources use of energy production requires less cost of mining, shipping, and processing of fuel. And we go on like that. It's statements that we can then look at and say, does this bill really fit within our venue? Or are we really getting outside of our calling? So we try to limit ourselves too, but so that we don't go off on every wild goose chase that there is. In current, we have some partnerships like Minnesota Interfaith Ecology Council, Sustainable Agriculture, Minnesota COAC, which is a seniors group, and we have resources in Minnesota, the Land Stewardship Project, International Alliance for Sustainable Agriculture, things like that. We try to set these sorts of things up so that we are flexible to respond to bills that come into the legislature, because they come up rather fast. And if you have to go back to the congregations every time, you may lose a moment. You try as much as quickly as possible, you send it out to the network to get feedback. But sometimes we have to take a stand up as a board, and sometimes we'll make a correct stand, and sometimes we'll make an incorrect stand. And we'll be responsive and responsible to whoever we've impacted. And that's the calling of how we go about doing that kind of... What kind of issues would you think the church should be, or maybe shouldn't be, involved in environmental areas? Where do you think that our calling comes in?
Sure. The pollution and population, is there a position on that by the church? Particularly the support of the United Nations and Population Council there, and they're trying to control population throughout the world.
I think it comes as a result of our hunger. Our hunger appeal network. Initially, we're trying to feed the populations that's there, but obviously there's got to be some degree of, you can do an issue on that. You see, that's the neat thing about this. It's not a case of, if there isn't a statement of it in the church, you can put hunger. Is it food, or is it population, or whatever? Basically, you can develop a network from there. The nice thing is it's rather flexible, but the church is a perfect place to have these issue forums, because we don't just come from the standpoint of weighing one population against another and things like that. We really rely on the scientific. We do bring in the scientific as much as we can. We bring in the social aspects. We do consider most of the things, but then we also talk about our responsibility as a calling, a biblical calling.
But I see population control or out of control is very basic to almost every environmental problem there is.
Right.
And I was disturbed when I got my alumni magazine and noticed how many of, you know, where they have announcements of death, birth, and everything, how many families were four people in this day and age.
What do you mean four people?
They were having their fourth child.
Oh, you mean six.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, and I thought, what is Augustana telling these young people anyway, back in this day when population control is? And I'm still pondering whether to write somebody in Augustana.
Yeah, but that's not a bad place to start. And the problem is we're in a bad situation because we're the society that has a lot. We're a society that has drawn the resources out of the other country. We're the society that has caused a lot of these population imbalances in other countries because of some of the resources. And we have to get non-judgmental at the same point that we recognize that these are problems which have to be solved in some fashion. And the question is how to get at them. The statement is that population has to come into control. Now the difficult thing the church has to weigh is how does it brought under control? Is it authoritarian? You're only allowed to have half a kid per family or something? I mean, whatever it is. Or is it rather finding some basic ways of supporting families so they don't feel they have to have these huge amounts or whatever? And that's going to be the real difficult issue. We're going to make mistakes. But we have to come at it in a way that doesn't, it's not the United States now or the Lutheran Church in the United States making a policy that now we know best, here you go, you know, and that's your, like you're talking about, the ivory tower intellectualizing that tells everybody what they need to be doing. At the same point, approaching it in a Christian manner, which is we understand that we are responsible for the following, and therefore, we want to make sure these people are fed. However, we want to make sure that the population, that their quality of life goes up so that perhaps the quantity of life doesn't need to go up. And we need to address those issues.
But I know that with the United States, we have, over the last 8 years of the Republican administration, have withdrawn and support the United Nations. And there are countries that want to support it. There are United Nations that want it. But we refuse, political point of view and religious, from the fundamentals on down, saying we're not going to support that. Okay.
But to give
you're not going to support what?
The United States would not make contributions to the United Nations, support family planning or population control around the world.
Well, to give you some idea of how the positives come out of this, and I should let you know what the positives. Because of our action, we're for some reason, because we've been working all these number of years now, and it isn't a whole lot, but it's enough. For some reason this year, a lot of these issues came up, such as the gambling issue, such as the treaty rights, where we were in the lead in a lot of those issues to begin with. The papers have picked up on this, and again our name has splattered forth across the as being in the lead in some of these issues. And people get to read the paper and they realize the church starts leading in issues of social, environmental, etc. areas. It becomes a good thing that starts happening because they start to recognize that the church is more than just a static body, that people can affect change and can be in the forefront, and some good bills have come out of it. When Health Right came out, Lutheran Coalition for Public Policy in Minnesota was one that was mentioned. That doesn't mean it's doing everything it's supposed to. We're very disappointed about how many people will actually be affected by Health Right, how many people will actually be affected by lead abatement bills, how the treaty rights are still going to court. But since we were in the forefront of it and it came to the press in the forefront, it got more Lutherans activated into the networks. Our networks have shot up in number. Mm-hmm. And so we have more activism and discussion within the church body, not utilizing only all of society's resources, but also the church's resources and concerns. And with that, and it's gone beyond Lutherans. I mean, it's gone beyond Lutherans. We've become part of coalition with senior citizens, with who are not necessarily Lutherans or whatever, with their concerns, with agricultural groups who are concerned with just keeping the family farm going or keeping farming an occupation somebody wants to go into. And they start looking to the church for it, instead of looking away from the church, instead of walking out of the church. Believe it or not, it becomes an amazing evangelical tool when the church is due, because at least you get angry at the church, you know. I mean, you come angry enough to step into a church and say, start waving your finger at the front and say, what are you people up to? You know, and we can start engaging in those discussions. If they're not there, we can't talk to them. And in many cases, we found that we're building a greater cross-cultural network with these kinds of things. It's been a very positive year. It's been extremely positive.
How do you respond to, I'm assuming you get responses like, how can you justify mixing religion with politics?
Sure, we get a lot of those responses. We have, what I'm going to do on tomorrow, and I don't know how many of you will be there tomorrow night, so maybe with it, talk about the basis for advocacy and moral deliberation in the church. The church as a center for moral deliberation. You'll find out that the church is no longer the center for moral deliberation. But more and more we have to become that again. People used to flock to the church, which was at the center of a town, when they had a problem. They don't flock there anymore when they have a problem. The churches can be a very safe place for people to talk, because there is a respect for each individual.
Does anyone talk about greed and exploitation as being inherent or concomitant part of the free enterprise society?
And yet we get letters written by Lutherans which you wouldn't believe Lutherans could write. The most incredibly racist, most incredibly, you know, I mean, so we run the gamut. And we respond. It's not like we don't respond. It's not like the bishops don't respond. But we also have to remember, anytime you take a position, don't backside your bishop either. You know?
No.
I mean, they sometimes are the lightning rods and they receive all the heat for us going off and running off and doing all these wonderfully amazing things. And they so we were told by the bishop on this one issue that he thought he was backsided. We had fed him all the information to begin with, but it didn't seem like it was as important on his death. We should have probably made a big red stamp on it and said, this you should be attention to. And we've tried to have more conferences with all the bishops, but they're so busy. Trying to get them all together in one room at one time is very difficult. We find that these are such important issues. I mean, they're so darn important. It's a shame that the church doesn't become involved, because when the church does become involved, you'd be surprised what you get from legislators. That they're thankful in some ways that the church gets involved. Not at the beginning, but later on, they are comfortable that at least they have a position that they can look at, deal with. Nobody likes secret agenda. Hmm. It's right there in the open with a statement of why we're there. And we can be wrong. We dare to be wrong for the gospel. I mean, and we will back up. It's not that we leave people smoldering in the dust. If a congregation feels bad, we make the special effort as a group, even when it's, you know, really decimating on us, to go out that extra mile and meet with them and discuss with them and invite them in and let them rant and rave at us. You know, and invite them into the conversation, not only in this issue but in other ones.
Does it always work? I mean, you talked about Red Wing earlier. Have you been able to heal that breach at all?
Not yet. Not yet, but it's an ongoing discussion. We haven't ever closed the door on it.